Station number 15433.
Back at Leaf Side 3. Mm. Okay, so you're saying you did this 80-mile march in a day and a half?
Yeah.
Right. What other subjects? Demolitions? What? Did you blow anything? Things up?
In actual fact, they took us there. We went to ranges. We set off charges and we did cutting charges and they were very much into shaped charges at that time. Mm. There was very little formula. It was different shapes. Diamonds, saddles, linears. Mm-hmm. And as I say, they got us in this exercise, and the battle picture was phenomenal. We parachuted in. You had to go and blow a water catchment pool, right? And they gave you all the sentries this and what time that. So we actually had to get into the water to put the charges in. I mean, you're talking about, it was cold. So we get in there and put the charges in. Then we go and meet an agent, and he says, now watch it. This agent's a heavy, heavy drinker, and you'll actually have to, interrogate this man deeply to get any information. In actual fact, we got there and the guy was drunk. Can you see that? I mean, he actually smelled a whiskey, we'd been warned about this. So he got us onto a safe house, and we were given a load of emergency RVs and whatnot. We got to the safe house, and there's a guy sort of hanging from the ceiling, with a big note on his chest, sort of traitor. So then we had to say, what are we going to do? We've got to move to the emergency RV, and then take up with the agent again. It was, honestly, your mind was working the whole time. And without realising that the miles you were putting in was phenomenal.
What equipment did you have actually on you at that time?
Right, we'd broke away from the conventional equipment, the web and that. And lucky for us, our selection had actually gone to Malaya, so we got those, the airdrop belts off. When they parachute the packages down, they have these big belts, the self-locking belts. So what we did is we cut them down and... you had what you called a belt kit. You normally carried your magazines on there, a day's escape rations, your compass, and a water bottle, in Europe. So we'd wear that, and that'd be slung. And then you'd have you'd have your rucksack with, your poncho and whatever rations you were carrying it. So if you had to dump the rucksack at any time, you had at least a day's rations on you to work with,
Right. Okay. Unarmed combat, or...?
Yeah, we did quite a bit of that. Uh-huh. And it was a little chap called Alex Spence that took us. And, he was good at it. And, Spence was years ahead of his time with the unarmed combat. He was the mother of the unarmed combat in the SAS. Him and another chap called George Stainforth uh-huh. at that time.
And you were quite good at that, were you, or...?
I had an aptitude for it. And and the thing about Spence is, Spence was streetwise. Can you see that? I mean, Spence could take a guy in a pub, or take him where he wanted. He, and he was fit, and he was wiry. He came from Edinburgh, and it was good fun doing it with him, because you were never allowed to stop. Like when Spence took you in training, you carried a pistol, a commando dagger, a garrote, and a baton. And if you weren't doing something like... if you were talking, you had to be stripping your weapon all the time. And you were never allowed not to do nothing. And what happened if you get caught? You were given so many press-ups, and you had to do them at the end of the day. But if I told Spence that you were doing something wrong, you got my press-ups, can you see it? So in actual fact, I became quite a bit of an informer, because I had to do the least press-ups at the end of the day, So something, because I always manage to be able. I never actually get caught by Spence. So, but what happened at the end of the course, the little 5-day course we done? The chaps got us together, and they threw me into a load of bushes, because I'd sort of grassed them all up to Spence,
But how did you get on well with the people there?
Oh, the instructors is. They were there the whole time, and in actual fact, they liked you. Can you see that? They genuinely liked the people.
Okay, let's go on. You said you got on well with everybody generally there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as I say, we were working so hard that there became a fantastic bonding between the chaps.
Yeah.
And you had the odd dispute, but it was professional disputes,
Uh-huh.
And there was a marvellous cross-section of guys as well.
Right.
And as I say, there was guys who were a lot older than I was, and you know, there was guys into their late 20s doing the course.
Mm-hmm. So what was the average age of people there then?
The average age,
well, and there
was about 24.
Was it? Right, okay.
I was only 19 coming 20.
Right. And so you finished with that. What about escape and evasion and that sort of thing?
Right, we went to Denmark, and every year our job was to train the Danish National Guard. We supplied the enemy for it, and it was a big sort of, the whole guard was nationalised, and we were enemy agents being parachuted in there, so it was a big thing for them. And we went on it, and we had to actually go and blow a target, and then after that there was an escape and evasion phase where you were trying to get yourself back out. Mm. And I was very lucky, I was with Spence, so we went in and attacked a electricity place, you know, put the charges on it, then we came away, and we managed to get away. We never actually got caught, but honestly, it was taken very, very serious by the Danes. Mm. And by the SAS. I mean, those guys were actually wrapping sacking around their feet so as they wouldn't leave footprints. Can you see that? And you know, there was an awful lot of skill used by the regiment at that time.
Right. And what about R2I interrogation and so forth?
Yeah, no, the you always got that. On most of the courses, you get an RV was bubbled.
Yes.
And you get in there, and you'd actually get caught, and they'd give you the old interrogation phase. Right. You know, you'd come in there, and they'd be the nice guy, the school teacher approach. You know, you had all the different approaches, and the great thing about it was you'd done a lot of training on it beforehand, and so when the guy came in, you actually knew what was coming, and the idea being was to sort of hold out. And they always had to have a go at the jocks, you know, with the fast temper, you know. And I remember that at the end of the phase, there was a guy called Parker, who was the guy in charge of the interrogation team, joint services interrogation team. And he said, he says, you jocks, he says, you're so easy. All you've got to do is get you wound up, you know. And you know, it was the different, you know, the different races, you know. Uh-huh. And all you had to do is you knew that as long as you lasted 36 hours, you were okay, or 24 hours, you know, for the duration. So, you know, you can say, right, they can do what they want, it can't last forever. So you tended to get your way through it, and it was a good little experience.
Mm. Mm. So you finished your training, and then you got qualified. You got what did you get, Berry and Wings, or how did that happen?
I was given my SAS Wings and Berry, and, you know, it was a presentation, and I then went to D Squadron, and I was the first draft that went to D Squadron for 2 years. You've got to understand, the SAS was only a small unit at that time, very small, 120 mm. men. Mm. And the thing that got me was, from the parachute regiment where nobody spoke to you for 6 months, you know, you haven't proved yourself. I met a guy called Ron Eddy, and I says, I've been posted here, can you tell me where I can get a bed? Certainly. Where's your kit? Came over and gave me a hand, can you see that? Mm. So I went to 16 troop. And then what they said was, I just arrived, and I says, you're going to the desert with 18 troop. Now, 18 troop, at that time, the average age of 18 troop was 32 years old. And 18 troop, I mean, they were old soldiers. And I got posted with them, and it was terrific. I mean, they go, right, stop, get the tea made. You know, I was the sort of, you know, I was a tea boy. But We went to Aden, and we
so what you
did vehicle borne off operations there,
right?
With 18 troop, we teamed up with the Rhodesian SAS, who came out and joined us in Aden, and you know, there was a marvellous.
So which year was this then?
This was 62. Aye.
And you and the this was out in the Radfan, was it?
No, that wasn't. The Radfan hadn't blew up. The Radfan never blew up to the following year, which was 63.
Right.
Yeah.
So. What, you were in Aden itself? Aye. Around so, Aden itself.
Aye, so we went from Aden, we drove up the coastline up to a place called Shukra. We moved up from Shukra up a big escarpment to Makela. And, you know, it was marvellous, you know, and it was like biblical times. I mean, we went to the top of the escarpment at Makela, we went to, there was an old palace there, I think it was Sheba. You know, it dated back to the Bible. I mean, I think Shukra is actually mentioned in the Bible as well. And it was interesting. And the guys were extremely kind to me. And you know, they say, right, there's four liners of machine gun ammunition, get young McAleese, and they'd take me out on the Browning machine gun, you know, machine gunning while I was moving, teaching me that. And there was...
What sort of vehicles were you in then?
Land Rovers, stripped down Land Rovers. Yeah. You know, with a Browning in the front and a Browning in the back.
Right.
Two Brownings, yeah.
And how many were you in the troop?
16.
16?
Yeah, four vehicles.
Four vehicles, yeah. Okay, and then how long were you operating for?
We went there for 6 weeks.
And so you got enough food, etc., for 6 weeks on out in the desert? Or?
No, we took one resupply when we were out. And it was funny, it came back on me later. I didn't realise it. They brought us in a load of fresh meat. And we linked up with the Rhodesians. And we were, next thing we've got this sort of carcass. I mean, there was never any sort of butchery. You just got a big chunk of flesh, you know. So we were all cutting up and making little blocks and that to get a sort of stew and a curry going. And the Rhodesians looked at it. And they just threw it and they started using it for bait for fishing, you know. And I couldn't understand, you know, this. And it, as I say, it came back later on to me, you know, when I joined the Rhodesian SAS. I mean, they used to get T-bone steaks in the bush. You know, not a chunk of flesh like we had.
Yeah.
You know, they went away and used it for fishing, and we did a bit of shark fishing. You know, they brought a shark in and bang, shot the shark, and then another shark came in and shot that. It was a place called Birali. In actual fact, I read a book later on, I think it was Traveller's Tales, I think Hemingway may have wrote a bit about it. And the other thing is, what was the name of this place? I can't remember the name of the village, but I read one of Hemingway's books, Traveller's Tales, and he explained this place in Aden where he came round the corner and there was many skyscraper buildings with irrigation, you know, water actually running through channels in the centre of the town. And honestly, it was like, when Hemingway wrote that book, it was like a picture. Can you see that? Mm. You know, it was that exactly the way I saw it.
Mm.
It was a really exciting trip. And that was when I see, you know, and what I remember from that trip, it was the first time I saw a Sputnik. You know, or what you'd call everything Sputniks then, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that satellite.
Going overhead.
Yeah, I was sitting there, look at that. So that star's moving, it was a Sputnik, you could see it sort of waving.
In the desert.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there any action on that occasion?
No.
And just how? I was going to ask you, creepy crawly. I mean, there you were. Right. You hadn't been abroad really before.
Yeah.
Was that the first time?
No. I'd been in Cyprus and Malaya. Yeah.
Ah.
I went to Cyprus with the parachute regiment.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
No, hold on. Yeah, I'd done an exercise in Cyprus prior to going to the SAS.
Ah, okay.
I missed that out, and I meant to mention it. Is that, you know, you had two and three para, one and three para stationed together, two para were in Cyprus.
Yes.
And we went out there and parachuted into Cyprus, and two para was the enemy, and they ran all over us, man. They were fit, you know, they were lean, they were solid, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were really professional, two para was. You know, we'd gone soft, we'd been in the UK. Parachute battalions shouldn't be stationed here, you know.
And at that time, when was the
McKellar thing?
No, when was Makarios and the emergency in Cyprus?
Oh, no, that was finished.
That was finished?
Yeah, just finished. And, you know, there was still a bit of an emergency on.
Yeah.
But it was all wound right. Down, you know. Yeah.
Okay. So, anyway, you were in
Aden. Yeah.
And, I mean, the heat and creepy crawlies and spiders and snakes, potentially.
There was me and a chap called Maury.
Sharks, Kroll. I mean.
Aye. You know, I'd never seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, we were driving along the beach, and there was millions upon millions of crabs running all over the beach, you know. And I used to just look. And then we drive into the desert, you know, a desert mountain. I mean, there's absolutely no water. I mean, we're sitting there rushing ourselves with water. The next thing, we get this flash flood. We're next to this escarpment. And the next thing, there's a river there where there was no river before. Can you see? I mean, the water was... It was clear and it was cool. You know, normally when, you know, later on in the desert when I came across water, especially in the dry season, you know, it was muddy and you had to strain it and all that, you know.
Okay. But you did it, you found that all part of novelty, or how was it?
It was, I think, the thing that got through to me was the standard of the soldiers I was with. they always taught you something, you know. They were learning, they say stop, and it was just, everything was always, there was an abundance of patience at that time in the regiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't in a hurry to get anywhere. Can you see that?
What happened? Okay, so what happened after? What happened after that?
Right. After that, I was shipped back one day before the rest of the squad and put in an aircraft, and I was told I was going to America to be stationed to do an attachment with the rest of the regiment to the American Special Forces.
Mm.
And it was really exciting, you know, flying out to Fort Bragg. I mean, I'm only 20 years old. I'm going to America. I mean, everybody dreamed about that because we were the first troops to go to America for training. Yeah. And
what was that? I was going to ask you, what about the medical side of that?
Oh, and the...
go on.
And the medical side of what?
Of the medical training.
Yeah.
Of first aid training and
no,
so forth.
No, at that time, the medics were the medics.
Oh,
and, you
right.
know, there was a medic to each troop. You know, our training wasn't at that standard. You had a troop medic and a troop signaller at that time.
All right.
Although some of the other guys could signal. Can you see that?
Right.
And this is the era before, you know, the cross-training. But, you know, a lot of guys had done demolition courses. But, you know, there was none of this. Every man must be a signaller, demolitions man, medic, you know.
Hmm.
With probably two or three guys had done medics courses. But there was a lack in with signals at that time. We normally had one or two troop signalers.
Yeah.
You know, what you did is you went out in small groups, reported back via radio, and the troop signaler kept the contact. And then I just joined the regiment as the transformation was coming in, so there were more signalers and medics than there were before.
Okay, Fort Bragg.
Yeah.
So what happened? So... How did you travel? What, London Airport? Old London
no,
Airport?
No, we travelled in a Comet 4, and we flew out there, and I got to, we landed in New Jersey first. Now, I was sitting in the airport, and it was a civilian airport, and this woman came along, and she says, are any wee Scots boys in here, you know? And, I mean, she was really taken in, you know, like I was only a wee, and she took me and bought me hamburgers. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this before, you know, big hamburgers, you know. She fed me and we carried on. We took off from New Jersey, arrived in Fort Bragg. And, I mean, we were a novelty as well. Can you see that? Everybody wanted to see these limeys, you know. You know, like we'd come from another planet. And the other thing was, as the American couldn't understand, was they thought all Englishmen spoke with an Oxford accent. You know, so there's all these Geordies and Jocks and, gee, honey, the women were really, gee, honey, let me hear your wonderful English accent, where are you fae hen, you know? So they're expecting sort of, you know, a lot of beautifully spoken people, you know. We got there and the first couple of days was all, you know, them telling their war stories and us telling ours, you know. But the thing that got me was, you know, the British officer of that time, we had fairly good officers, but we had also some fairly bad ones. You know, let's not, you know. And these American officers tended to be, you know, they were sort of stocky, and everybody, you know, they looked as if they'd come off an assembly line. Everybody had cropped hair, every badge was in the correct place, there was nothing, you know, and these immaculately built boots. And we've got the officer corps there, you know, they had this obsession for wrapping their putties around their denims, you know, and they'd sort of be flicking along. And we had an American Special Forces panel there and a British Army panel, so they put us in the Special Forces in this sort of big cinema, and we could ask questions about each other's regiments. And the guy would go, for those of you that don't know me, my name is Sergeant so-and-so, my MOS is so-and-so, so-and-so, the country I study is Panama, you know. And you see the guy, he actually came from Panama, you know. And, whereas our officers, you know, they say, okay, who are you? Yes, chaps, and you know, they seem to have effeminate movements compared with these Americans. I mean, these Americans are all sitting there, you know, but it was the British officers of that time, you know, some of them were good officers, but some of them were blimps, you know. I'm going to be honest with you, know, that's what we felt at the time, and you know, as I say, there's no use telling you something else, you know.
And what did the Americans make of all this?
Oh, they were really taken in by it, because, I mean, the charge of the light brigade, and, you know, but, you know, they seen all these potential cardigans about, you know. And, you know, I looked at the the officer called, in actual fact, the thing that used to let them down was their dress. I mean, they were okay in uniform. You know, when you had them in full uniform, they were they looked fairly good. Put them in a pair of denims and a parachute smock. I mean, they don't know how to dress, you know. And the Americans, they loved it all, you know. And then,
what did you make of the Americans then?
I personally liked them. Uh-huh. I found them, to be honest, people. Mm. And I found that they could be honest with the mistakes that they'd made.
Uh-huh.
You know, because America is a soul-searching nation. They're always looking for something to soul-search about anyway. You know, they couldn't understand the concept of the four-man patrol. You know, to them it was just, you know, you just don't work in those numbers, you know. In actual fact, it came on later with them when they started forming LERT units and whatnot. But at that time, they had an A team, which was 10 men. A B team was two A teams, or so many A teams, you know. And it was a bulk of senior ranks and officers. Can you see that? I mean, the lowest rank in Special Forces was probably a sergeant. You never got troopies in it.
Mm.
So I looked at their system and I looked at the training, the actual courses. The courses were phenomenal. I mean, a medic did an 18-month course. You know, there used to be a place called Dogland, and they actually operated on dogs and everything. You know, any stray dog around Fort Bragg went missing. You know, they'd be doing operations on the Special Forces. And, you know, don't talk about this, you know, but everybody knew about it, you know. There was a dog for about 100 miles around the base.
They call it Dogland.
Dogland, you know, we actually went and operated on the dog, you know.
The reason I was asking about the Americans and the medics was that I understood that when advanced medical first aid training was first given to the SAS, that it was British Medical Association or hospitals were approached.
Yeah.
And they said, well, and they wanted to operate people. How do you operate in somebody if you're in the field?
Yeah.
They said, well, you can't do that unless you're a doctor, you know, with a BMA. And so we contacted the American.
Yeah.
And the American medical profession, whoever they contacted, said, well, no, it's all right. We'll sort that one out. And whatever happens,
it's a British
final
thing.
To that, I don't know. But, I mean, obviously,
In actual fact, when the heavy medical training started was in America.
Mm.
Those guys went to America, and for the 4 months we were there, they were doing medical training.
Your ablokes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, like, you know, for example, we didn't carry drips then in our medical packs. We just carried the little pack, and the first time I saw drips was in America.
Mm.
And they took it really seriously. And, you know, when I think back is in Malaya and what the regiment did in Malaya, I mean, considering they were in the unknown, I'm surprised that, you know, that if the casualties would have been heavier and a lot of wounded, I think they could have been in fairly deep trouble, because they didn't have the medics could patch a guy up and maybe stabilise him, but not to the extent of the boys nowadays. They've done hospital attachments. I mean, for example, I've actually sat in an operation, I've sat in an amputation. I mean, that was unknown in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was one in the Rhodesian SAS later on, there was a guy called Sandy Kirk, was a doctor. He says, right, I'm going to do a cut down, come with me. The guy shot straight in there, and you know, he showed him how to do a cut down. You know, when you're going for the artery, you know, the femoral artery down the side, he went whack in. You know, he says, that's how you do it. And he actually showed the guys.
This was in an operating
room?
What were they doing that for?
A guy they'd brought a casualty in, and the guy was still
bleeding. Yeah.
And, you know, he was. In actual fact, I don't know if it's severed on the way in or what, but he just ran in there, says, quickly, come with me. And he showed them how to do it.
So he cut into into the leg, grabbed hold of the artery and stopped it there.
You know, I mean, when you actually do that cut down, you know, you can't be nice about it. You know, you can't just, you know, I'm going to hurt this guy. You've got something like 2 minutes.
And the guy's still conscious.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got to go straight in there like that, pair of pliers and clamp it off, maybe with pliers, or, you know, if you've got forceps, you know.
This was where, in Fort Bragg, or?
No, this was later on in my career.
Oh, right, okay.
But, you know, Fort Bragg first made the regiment aware of all these things, you know.
Right.
As I say, their actual courses were better than ours at that time.
Right.
The demolition course was more intense as well.
Really?
Yeah, and they had a greater collection of foreign weapons than we had.
Right.
Yeah, but then again, it was America, you know.
Yeah. in the comments that I've heard, even from Americans, are that when they do our courses, that they've said that our courses are better.
Yeah.
They cover as much.
Yeah.
Or more.
Yeah.
Or it's higher quality.
Yeah.
The same subjects, higher quality.
Yeah.
But it's in a shorter space of time from people that have done the American course and the British course.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm only reporting what people have said. I've never done an American course.
I can
course.
Only tell you my observation. I found them to be extremely professional people. A bit parrot fashion. We instruction them. My name is Sergeant so-and-so, you know, and my MOSs are the following. But they knew the subject. I think on tactical things, and in the tactical side, I think we're far superior to the Americans in it. Mm. But, you know, and the application of a course into a tactical situation, I think we're better than the Americans are. But the actual setting up of the courses, I think they have the money and the expertise to go deeper into the subject and longer than we have.
What would you say they're over-specialised or too compartmentalised?
No, too... The mistake
that's one of the things that people say.
The mistake I saw at that time was to take 10 men and they say, right, you've applied to come to Special Forces, you're an ex-artilleryman. Mm. You know, they say, right, you're a heavy weapons man. You know, so you learn all about heavy weapons. And then they'll take a guy from the medical corps, he becomes the medic. Take a guy from the intelligence corps, he's an intelligence officer. Mm. And then they just band these group of men together. And they'll say, right... Right, the Spanish speakers, but the Spanish speakers are actually guys from Puerto Rico or somewhere. Mm. Can you see that? So they're fairly fluent, and but when they get them together, you know, it's not like a troop in the British Army where you live together the whole time. They just bring the team together and then they make them a team, and they go away and do the job. Can you see that?
Okay, it's only formed up for one operation.
No, it was formed up like 16 troop would always be 16 troop.
Yeah.
Aye, but an A team wouldn't always be the same A team.
That's what I'm saying. Americans would just form it up for the day or whatever it might be.
Yeah, or for an operation.
For the operation. Yeah, that's what I was meaning.
Yeah, or for a tour, you know.
Yeah, okay. So regimental spirit and all that sort of thing.
What I found out with the Special Forces is, you know, the typical thing happened. Kennedy came along and says, they sure look good. Give me 15,000. Can you see that? And, you know, the original American Special Forces was, I think it was the... And the badge was different then. They used to have a Trojan horse as a badge. And there was the 10th who were stationed at Bad Tulks, and there was the 7th who were in America. And then they expanded to the 10th, 7th, 1st, 3rd, 5th. And it finished up, there was a division of Special Forces. Mm. And when you get a division strong, I don't think you can be
special anymore. Yeah. What would you say that their Special Forces in the sort of person that they've got in it now has changed? Or
what I find out about the Special Forces, and I think it probably goes through yours as well, into this behaviour thing. Mm. You know, to be a good soldier, you've got to be well behaved. And as somebody who wasn't well behaved, you know, I tend to look at it and dissect it and take it apart to try and find out why I never fitted in, say, as well as I should have done. I mean, they went through one stage there was, you know, the reborn Christian phase. It sort of swept through the Special Forces. Excuse me, sir, I've got to go and consult my conscience about this. I'm sorry, it doesn't work like that.
What did you work out about the fitting in?
Right, the fitting in was... now, I took my whole career and I said, I crammed an awful lot into it. And if I hadn't been a badly behaved guy, I couldn't have moved on and got through as much as I get through, because I'd have probably finished up being in the regular army and being demobbed as another boring sergeant major who spoke about what he'd done, and his children all march up and down the house and get up at 0:30 in the morning. So through my behaviour, it moved me on to other things. And I looked at it, and it really came home to me last year. I went to the 40th anniversary of D Squad, and this chap went, "Hello, Michael, he's behaving yourself." Now, I'm 52 years of age now. When I misbehaved, I was 25, 24.
Yeah.
And I says, you know something? There's something that really comes to me here. I'm the person that's grown up, not you. Mm-hmm. Your attitude is still exactly the same as it was when you were 25, the same age as me. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it, and they weren't great soldiers. They were guys who cruised along, and they were malleable. You could put them into the shape you want. I was a wee bit of a stallion. I was wild, but I was never a bad soldier.
Mm.
Never.
Mm.
And you know, and I can say that to you with conviction.
Mm.
But my behaviour left an awful lot to be desired.
How in brief would you did this bad behaviour manifest itself?
Probably,
if you don't mind my asking,
probably a chip on my shoulder.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Glasgow thing, and the other thing is I was on a short fuse all the time.
Mm.
I mean, if somebody says something to me, the argument was on, and I wasn't going to leave it till he got the edge on me. I used to just wallop them, and people used to say, "What that man needs is a good hiding." I had tons of good hidings, tons of them. I always sort of came back for more. You know, and I'm not glamorising it now, but you know, I can understand myself more now,
mm-hmm.
which is really a fantastic thing. But you know, to turn around and say, "Would you change it all?" Some of the guys I walloped needed walloping, and some of the guys that walloped me deserved to wallop me as well. So, you know, why really, you know, why, you know, sit here and say I was a bad soldier because of that? I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was an awkward soldier. Probably, I was never. If somebody told me something to do in a military sense, like you know, for example, I loved. I was a drinking person. I was never a drunkard. I